This episode of Standard Orbit is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program for the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. Want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
This is Walter Koenig, Chekhov from Star Trek, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Risk is our business.
It's like nothing we've dealt with before.
By golly, Jim, I'm beginning to think I can cure a rainy day.
I can't change the laws of physics.
Now in standard orbit, sir.
Welcome everyone to Standard Orbit, Trek FM's dedicated podcast that covers the original and new cast of Captain Kirk and the Enterprise. I am Zach Moore. Ken Tripp is off filming the Green Berets this week, but worry not, you won't have to listen to just me this episode. I am very happy to be joined by Trek FM's content manager and a voice that's getting a lot of play around the network recently, Mr. Justin Oser. What's up, Justin?
Hi. Just happy to be here on Standard Orbit. Yeah, I'm kind of making my way around the network, it seems like.
It seems that way, yeah. So, Justin, you had a show idea for us this week, and I'm very excited to talk about it. Why don't you preface what we're going to be discussing tonight on Standard Orbit?
Sure. Well, I wanted to talk about the episode Errand of Mercy, first season episode. We get the introduction of the Klingons, and it's always been one of my favorites. I think that there's a lot of interesting things going on in the episode, discussions about, you know, war and peace and torture and what you do if you have a lot of power and things like that. So I really wanted to talk about this episode, which I think hasn't been focused on specifically before on Standard Orbit.
Yeah, Errand of Mercy, you know, for me, it's not one of the episodes that I grew up watching a lot. I grew up watching whatever episodes my parents had taped off TV, so it didn't happen to be in that collection. So, you know, I grew up with episodes, you know, like Arena or City and Legend Forever or Trouble with Tribbles or even like The Savage Curtain, right? So episodes like that, ones that I'd revisit. Errand of Mercy, I haven't seen it that many times, so it's still pretty fresh. So, you know, it's actually going to be fun to discuss this one because it's not one that I've, you know, lived with and said all I had to say in my nerdy conversations over the years. So it's cool when you revisit these episodes that you haven't seen in so long or haven't seen very much of, and it's almost like discovering new Star Trek in a way.
Yeah, and you know, I haven't talked about it too much elsewhere on the network, but I'm actually a fairly recent Star Trek fan as far as being like a big fan of Star Trek. The first thing that I remember seeing was Star Trek VI in the theaters. So that was 1991. Of course, that was a while ago. But it didn't necessarily make a huge impression. I thought, this is great, and I kind of moved on. But it was really the Kelvin Timeline movie starting with 2009 that really made me a big fan and caused me to go back and really watch everything in Star Trek. And I started out with TNG and went on to DS9 and Voyager and kind of continued from there. And it took me a little time to kind of come back to the original series. So I don't think that I actually saw this episode until about 2 years ago, and I've just seen it a couple of times. So I don't know, maybe that'll give it a different perspective. But you know, my history with Star Trek, I think, is a little bit different than some other people around the network.
Oh, it's awesome, man. I mean, it's great how many different roads there are to Star Trek for so many people. I mean, that is exactly what is so great about the Kelvin Timeline, is because, you know, you had seen Star Trek in the past, you're like, yeah, it's pretty cool, yeah, but Abrams movies come out, reinvigorates whatever, you know, fandom flame you might have had there, and now here you are on a Star Trek podcast. So,
yeah,
little did you know.
Little did I know. I mean, and now it's kind of like grown over time, and now it's such a big part of my life. I'm watching Star Trek every day, reading Star Trek novels, listening to Star Trek podcasts, and, you know, interacting on Facebook and Twitter and all of that. So it's kind of grown into this huge thing where it wasn't that much a part of my life even 10 years ago.
To that point, then, I'm just curious, for the Kelvin Timeline movies, right? How would you rank them, since they're like your entry point into Star Trek?
Yeah, at this point, I would rank Beyond first. I think it's the best of the three, and then 2009, and then Into Darkness.
That's a pretty good order right there. Yeah. My thing is I go back and forth with Beyond and 09 because I feel like as a whole, Beyond is like a better overall movie and story. It has more to it, you know, more depth to it. But with 09, there's so many great moments. Like, I think that, so it's, it balances out so well, and it's tough. But yeah, if I had to make a call, I would rank those the same way as well. And hopefully, we'll have many more Kevin Timeline movies to rank in the future.
I certainly hope so, yeah.
That's cool, man. Well, let's go back in time, much like Spock did, and Nero, in Star Trek 09, and talk about Aaron of Mercy. Now, this episode is the first appearance of the Klingons in Star Trek canon. I mean, that's crazy because this is at the tail end of season one of the original series. You look back at the original Star Trek and like, the Klingons were there the whole time. It's like, no, not really. Were they?
No, I mean, this is episode, I think it's 26 or 27 of the first season. So no Klingons before that. And I mean, of course, people, I think, have this idea that the Klingons appear a lot in the original series, but it's really not a huge number of episodes. I mean, it's Errand of Mercy and Trouble with Tribbles, Day of the Dove, Friday's Child, probably missing one or two in there, but it's not a huge number of episodes.
Private Little War.
Private Little War, that's the other one.
Land of Troyus.
Right.
And that's...
Well, there's...
And Savage Curtain.
Savage Curtain,
that's
seven.
Seven I think that might be it.
79.
Oh, do we say Day of the Dove?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah.
So, you know, not a huge number.
if we're wrong, someone will let us know, I'm sure.
I think that probably gets the main ones, but yeah, I mean they appeared a good deal, but not, you know, all the time. And I think they became more prominent when you get to the movies and, you know, TNG and DS9.
Yeah, and if you look back at the original series, you remember the big three Klingons: Kor, Koloth, and Kang. Well, you know, if the powers that be had their way back in the day, you wouldn't have all those Klingons. It'd just be Kor, because John Colicos is Kor. He was planned to be in A Private Little War, Trouble with Tribbles, and Day of the Dove. And just with the scheduling conflicts, he couldn't make it. So we got a bunch of Klingon characters, you know, three of which became iconic and came back on Deep Space Nine. So it became part of the deeper tapestry of Star Trek. And I love that when production things get incorporated into the universe somehow, and then it just becomes, like, Star Trek as we know it, like it becomes the mythology of Star Trek, and I love that little wrinkle in things.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I do find it interesting that they wanted to bring him back. I mean, I think he makes such a great impression as Kor. You know, I was rewatching it yesterday, and man, he does such an amazing job, and really, you know, sets the stage for all of the performances I think you see for Klingons later on.
Right, I mean, he was the template. Him and the makeup director, John Chambers, I believe. Mm-hmm. If I'm mistaken, someone let me know. Yeah. But they invented the Klingon look in like a couple of hours, because in the script, Gene Kuhn only described him as, and I quote, "hard-faced Asian types." That's the only true description, and that's, you know, that's a pretty vague. That could mean anything, right? And so John Colicos came up with the Fu Manchu kind of Genghis Khan look, and with the hair and the darker skin. And it's just crazy. This is how Klingons look, you know, for a few years until the motion picture, right? But they just established the main villains of Star Trek look like in a makeup chair in a couple of hours. And again, it's going back to what I'm talking about. And it just became so iconic. Now, he's the most made-up Klingon. I mean, I wish they would have spent a little more time on all the other guys.
The other ones they're just you know, regular humans just in some other uniforms pretty much.
You know, even his first interest is kind of like Darth Vader-esque, right? You get that the two guards that come in, and he comes through the open door. It's like they knew, like, this is like a big deal. This guy, he's a big villain, and he's not just two dimensional. And that's much like the Romulan commander before him in Balance of Terror. Like, these guys are three dimensional characters. They're not just, you know, black headed bad guys. Like, I'm gonna take over this colony and get you, Kirk. He has a lot of personality.
Yes.
You know, I mean, he's frustrated at the fact that these Organians on this planet are just smiling all the time. He's very savvy as well. He notices that Kirk and Spock are different. He's like, where are your smiles, you know?
That's right. He's very observant about what's going on. I mean, at the same time, he's willing to use, you know, brutality to get what he wants, but he is definitely very observant and thoughtful and more three-dimensional. I mean, it's actually pretty impressive inside of the episode that you get to see all of these different aspects of this villain. Yeah.
Yeah, and he sees the similarities between the Klingon Empire and Starfleet, and Kirk doesn't. And I like that because Kirk in this episode, right? Kirk, he's an imperfect protagonist, right? And I like that because he's relatable because he gets so frustrated. I mean, he's so just angry at the Organians the whole time. And that's just like, you know what? I don't see Picard ever doing that, but I like that about Kirk because he's flawed, you know?
Yeah, and well, that's what I find fascinating. I mean, it definitely points up his flaws, and it's trying to, you know, really make the point that these Klingons are introduced as being so incredibly brutal, but really, when it comes down to it, Kirk is just as eager to have a war that might kill millions of people as Kor or any of the Klingons are, and they kind of share that in common, and it points up you know, the commonalities you wouldn't have thought of maybe at the beginning of the episode when they're first introduced.
Right, and the Klingons are more self-aware of it than Kirk is. Yeah,
so. Yeah, they know exactly what they want, and they're willing to go to war, and Kor at the end says, oh, it would have been glorious if we would have been able to, but Kirk's actually embarrassed by it. He's like, man, I was going to go to war, and we didn't really have to. So yeah, you're right. They're more aware of what they're doing, and Kirk really isn't, and it points up, you know, some of the flaws in his character, but you know, he does recognize that at a certain point, and it's to his credit that he recognizes where he was going. But yeah, he was kind of, I think, deluding himself for a lot of the episode and saying, you know, what right do you have to stop us from doing this? And one of the reasons I really like the episode is that it really kind of gives a way of enforcing, you know, peace and trying to get two peoples that want to go to war with each other to really look at themselves and try to restrain them from what they're doing. I actually, I really like that in the episode.
Yeah, I mean, this was a science fiction version of what was going on in the political culture of the 60s, right? You had the Americans being Starfleet. You had the Russians, the communists being the Klingons, right? And, you know, of course, the Romulans at this point were the Chinese. That was kind of the idea. And the Klingons were the Russians. And, you know, and Organia was, you know, Vietnam or Korea or whatever disputed territory at the time you want to call it. That's a strong point. I feel like that translates a little more A to B in an episode like Private Little War, where it doesn't turn out like, oh, the natives are super powerful godlike beings. Stop the fighting. So I think that, and that's a really cool sci-fi twist. I did enjoy that because you're thinking the whole episode because they're doing odd things. They're like, oh, 8 ships are now in orbit and hundreds of men have transported down. And Spock's like, Spock and Kirk, how do they know this? but it's a cool sci-fi twist. But at the same time, it kind of blurs the parallels to, you know, the actual political climate going on. So, I mean, I guess it's a give and take there.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, and I think for the Organians, it's interesting. They're really trying to do things from a point of non-interference. Like, we don't want to interfere with what you're doing. Do whatever you want as long as there's not violence or harm. But they're kind of forced toward the end to restrain them and to interfere. It's like they have their own prime directive for what they can and can't do, and they're really trying to strictly enforce it, and they're just really pained at the end that they have to actually do something to restrain them.
Now, have you seen Enterprise, where the Organians come back?
I have, yeah, and it's funny that you mentioned that because, you know, I thought I had seen everything in Star Trek, but I realized I had, the other day, that I had skipped over the observer effect. So I was like, "Oh, we're going to be talking about an episode of the Organians. I need to I need to rewatch that." But yeah, I just saw it, and that's actually a really good, I think, a really good follow up episode to see, you know, kind of what they were like before what we see in Errand of Mercy.
Yeah, they got their predictions wrong when I think they said about 5,000 years to meet the
be ready in 5,000 years. Oops, they came by a little bit early.
Right. No, that's interesting though. I think you know, Enterprise, it was hit or miss with those prequel episodes. I mean, for every observer effect, you get a acquisition. But anyway, moving on from that.
Not a fan of that one either.
It was it was interesting that they would go back to them in a prequel as opposed to a sequel, because there's so many super powerful godlike beings on the original series. Like, we're not going to list them here. Maybe we'll do an episode about that one day, comparing them all. But you get kind of desensitized to it after a certain point on TOS. Like, oh, look, the super powerful being. They're going to step in and end the fighting, and this and that. And then where are all these beings come the 24th century, right? I mean, it's a big galaxy. Don't get me wrong. I don't feel like we need to account for all of them. But you do wonder, like, what happened to these guys, right? What's the deal?
Well, I think probably after this time, everybody just steers clear because they don't want to have to deal with these beings that if you try to, you know, interfere, commit any kind of violence, they'll just restrain everything you want to do. So I think probably everybody just knows, like, hey, just avoid this planet. The Organians are too much trouble.
Put out those orange cones around the surface.
Yeah.
so with the faux appearance of the Organians, right? What did you think about that? Because Spock summarizes at the end of the episode that it was created so that visitors such as themselves could have conventional points of reference. So almost like when the Voyager crew went to the Q Continuum, right? And we see the old dusty road and all that. So that's weird that they would feel the need to even do that. You know, I just thought that, again, a cool sci-fi twist. I don't know if it was thought all the way through. So I think that kind of that makes the episode not quite the classic that other ones are, because once you start to think about it, you're like, well, that was odd. They just put on this facade of being a pre-industrial village that hasn't changed in thousands of years just so the Klingons and the Federation could have somebody to talk to. You know, I don't know. That struck me as odd.
Yeah, now that I think about it, maybe it is a little bit odd, but maybe you could think about it in terms of their policy of non-interference. I mean, maybe they were trying to project this idea that they weren't threatening, you know, maybe saying, there's nothing here, you don't need to visit, just keep on moving. But if they do happen to come down, I think they would want to kind of show what's been expected. Although Spock does say in the episode that they're seem to be less technologically advanced than they would have thought from, I don't know if they had other observations or a probe or something like that, but yeah, it does seem a little odd. Yeah, and then they disappear into, you know, beings of pure energy and just leave, you know, all these surroundings behind. So what is it, just like an empty planet now?
Yeah.
Well, and the Organians maybe just didn't explain all of the things that they do. Maybe they just wanted to leave this in place just to observe them at that point and see.
Well, yeah, but they do. This is a rare bit of continuity that continues on past this episode in TOS, because they mentioned the Organian Peace Treaty in the future, which is why the Klingons and the Federation aren't at war. So that's interesting that they would call back to this, and I'm glad they recognize it, because this is a major thing, guys. Because you know a lot of episodes are like, oh, we're going to war, and you don't go to war. You know you're not going to war, right? Because it's an alien you're never going to see again or something like that, right? But with the Klingons, I mean, they didn't know this at the time, but they said, okay, we're going to bring these guys back. The whole climax of their last appearance was, we can't go to war because the super powerful race stopped us. We have to address that in some aspect, and I appreciated that.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And I think there are some books as well that mention that, like, oh, we've got this Organian peace treaty. We've got to be careful with the Klingons, you know. Yeah, so it does have this impact, and I guess you can think of it affecting their decisions in the background even when they're not mentioning it.
You know, I thought, and I'm thinking about a lot of different ways this episode kind of echoed in later Star Trek watching it, right? Because I think about, okay, the Organians are kind of like the prophets in Deep Space Nine, where they kind of interfere with the Dominion War, you know, and not in the same way, obviously, but, you know, they do step in and help the Sisko out later on. Spoilers. Yep. I also thought, you know, the way the Organians are presenting themselves here, to get back to them, it's kind of like the Baku, right? Just a very, like, simple, you know, no technology, we're just here on our planet doing our thing, you know, kind of way. Although theirs was just a facade, you know, they were beings of pure energy. But I did, and that's, and I keep coming back to this ending, right? Because I'm just thinking about it, and, like, they do just disappear, and that's odd. And I thought, you know what, that's kind of enlightening to think that if this was their natural state, they just chose to be this way, because, like, they've, in all their, you know, thousands of years of evolution or whatever, they've decided, you know what, this is the most content state of being, just, you know, being happy and farming the land and, you know, being pre-industrial. Like, I think maybe there would be something to say for that, because as plugged in as we are today, I think we all have that inner calling to be like, man, I wish I could just, like, get away from it all and unplug. And, you know, maybe they've reached that higher form of enlightenment and be like, you know what, this is the best way to live life. We've run around for thousands of years. We've lived it all. But this is what we choose. And I think that would have been an interesting way to do it. And I guess you could still see it that way. The episode is vague enough at the end that maybe once everybody leaves, they say, okay, are they all gone? All right, let's go back to what we're doing. So
that could be. I mean, it could also be that, you know, they wanted to appear in some kind of humanoid form as another means of non-interference, because, you know, once you know, the Klingons and Starfleet know that there are these powerful beings, it's going to affect, or it might affect, their societal development or how they think about things. Because I think even at the end, Kirk says something like that it's going to affect him knowing that, you know, they're not the most powerful thing out there anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, so maybe they
as opposed to like 3 weeks ago when I met Charlie X and, you know, and the Metrons and the.
No, I was thinking about that too. Like, oh, you met some powerful beings before, but okay.
Right, Squire Gothos, and anyway,
but,
move on.
Yeah, but I mean, inside of this episode, the Organians, I think, affect things probably more than those other powerful beings that they've encountered, because they had the power to stop their fleets and to, I think they say, stand on their homeworld and, you know, prevent them from doing anything. So out of all the powerful beings, they actually seem like the most powerful because they're able to have such a huge impact across a large part of the galaxy.
That's a great point. I'm glad you brought that up. He said that, as I stand here, I stand on your homeworld and your homeworld. And I thought, like, was he, is he, like, projecting himself? He's, like, up in the sky? You know, that was... What was your take on that? Because I thought that was a very interesting concept, that they could just project themselves across the galaxy in that way.
You know, I didn't really think of it literally that they're standing on their homeworld, but I think he meant it in a similar way to, you know, they stopped the ships in the fleet from operating, and they made all of these weapons too hot to handle, that it was the same kind of thing, like all of the activity that could in any way relate to violence or war or their ships or anything was stopped. I don't take it as they were literally being kind of projected like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, they were super powerful. They could do it if they wanted, but...
Seems like it.
Yeah. But, you know, we've been talking about the fleets here. And this episode, again, I wasn't very familiar with it. So, watching off the top, I'm like, oh, Klingon ship, space battle. They just blew one up you know, before the opening credits. Like, this is pretty intense for Star Trek, right?
Yeah, that's definitely true. But I think when it was originally broadcast, they didn't even show the ship itself, the D7. They just showed an explosion, and it was only added back in, or not added back in, but added in for the remastered, right?
Correct. That is some retroactive retconning there from the remastered team, which is, you know, completely appropriate now that we know what a Klingon ship looks like. They did it here. They did it in, I think they did it to a certain extent in Friday's Child. I think they made a different Klingon ship, but it was just a blob before, and then they made it like a Klingon design ship. Yeah. We saw a Kolos ship in Trouble with Tribbles, you know, and this is all pre-season 3, and season 3 is when they built the D7. Then it also became the Romulan ship, which I love talking about. But so it's interesting that is cool, because look, if they had a ship, they had the money, you would have seen it, you know.
Sure.
And that's something, you know, that everybody was like, you know, when you had this list of episodes for when they did remastered, right? They're like, oh man, Doomsday Machine, oh man, Ultimate Computer, I can't wait to see those. You get to Erin and Mercy, and you're like, oh, well, it would be nice to see the Klingon fleet and the Starfleet, you know. But there's no time in the episode. You can't,
right,
like, create new scenes. And they only did that a couple of times, and it was only like Amok Time, for example. They created a new wide shot with Kirk, Spock, and McCoy walking to the arena. But I thought that was fine, because it's like, look, it's borderline George Lucas, but it's not quite, because, like, look, they're just walking. Don't you want to see the scope of it all? And, you know, when Spock's beaming out, they do a similar thing. So there was just no time to edit in. I don't know where they could have. Now, we did see some Klingon ships, you know, from a distance. No, we didn't see any kind of, well, there wasn't a battle anyway, so there's nothing to see. So, again, remastered, I think they took it as far as they could without, like, I mean, you can't edit out any of the story.
Right. Well, and I think it would have changed how you perceive the episode if they had a shot like, here are the big fleets, like some DS9 style shot where there's, like, you know, dozens or hundreds of ships. I think it would change how you see the episode. And I think that one of the things I found interesting was the things that maybe they didn't have the resources to show, but that actually were really effective because they didn't show it. So, you know, Kor's talking about this device to be able to scan your mind or
the mind sifter,
the mind sifter, or at the higher setting, the mind ripper. So, you know, they're describing it, and they give it all of these different names and kind of leave it up to your imagination to think of how awful that would be. And I think it's actually more effective than if they had a scene of like Spock suffering or whatever. I kind of like in this instance that maybe they didn't have the time or the resources to show a scene like that, but you're just imagining as Kor is describing it, how brutal it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sometimes, you know, the theater of the mind is the most effective one for sure. And, You know, talking about the beginning of the episode a little bit, I did love, this was another a case of them saying the Klingon ship, or a ship detected in this quadrant. That yes. always makes me laugh.
Yep.
Yeah, we should talk about this show in the continuity episode, right?
I know, going from quadrant to quadrant.
Yes, yeah, right. And then, you know, we have another instance of Vulcanian. I believe this is the last time. One. Yeah, and then it's interchangeable. Like, sometimes he's referred to as Vulcanian and Vulcan in this very same episode.
That's right.
So that almost makes it okay. You know, it's like, okay, we're going to mix these together. So it can be, like, either way. Like, I know there's some... I don't know if there's, like, some cities, like, that you can call... Like, I'm from Houston, right? So... I'm a Houstonian, but I guess people could call me a Houstonite if they really wanted to. Like, I don't know, like Boston, right? What are people from Boston called, Justin? Do you know? Because I don't know.
Bostonian,
right? But could it... Huh, I got Ken, you know, right? I'm sorry, Ken. Bostonite, you know? I don't know. I mean, you could, right? So,
right, maybe.
I think, I'm pretty sure, you know, up the road... Hey, we're both fellow Texans, by the way. So, Texas right. forever, brother. Austin, right? They're called Austinites, are they not?
That one I don't know. There are some cities I don't know what
they
call themselves.
I don't think they're called Austonians. I think they're because you know that's Bostonians. I'm pretty sure they're called Austinites. So anyway, all that to say, there's plenty of pronunciations. I would love in Star Trek Discovery if they break out some Vulcanians, right? Just somebody just say that. I'd be like, yes, I know what you're talking about. Like, somebody watched the original series. Yes. So
yeah, it's just an alternate thing. I don't know it using. You know, Vulcan and Vulcanian in the same episode. It does feel odd, and I'm not sure if they just weren't sure what to use or they thought that there would be some kind of explanation. I don't know. But it always strikes me as odd the few times that you hear it.
Well, and, you know, Kirk has a pseudonym, right, in this episode. But Spock is like, I am Spock. I am a Vulcan merchant. Like, come on, Spock. Like, yeah. I'm pretty sure you're pretty famous, too. Kor knows who Kirk is, right? Once he finds out who he is, he's like, delighted. Oh, the captain of the Enterprise. He's like that, too. Yeah. Like, he's familiar with him, like, by reputation, but he doesn't, like, know what he looks like. So when,
man,
when
he doesn't have the Kirk trading card.
Yeah, exactly. Right. He's not going through the holograms. You know, like, Nero has those holograms of Spock and stuff.
Yeah. I was thinking, like, wouldn't... I mean, if Kirk is a Starfleet captain and, you know, assigned to that... quadrant or whatever it is. I mean, wouldn't
that quadrant,
he know?
Yes.
wouldn't they have some intelligence or know what Kirk would look like? One would think, but
I was hoping, like, oh man, if I remade this episode, I would have him go by Selik. You know, his it's just his pseudonym from yesteryear in the animated series. Uh-huh. I would make it like Spock's thing, right? Whenever he's like undercover, like, oh, I'm Selik. You know.
Yeah.
I thought that'd be cool.
You know what? I half expected Spock, you know, in some way to hide his ears, just put on like a little hat or something, but. Nope. Everybody's going to know he's Vulcan.
It's always funny to see in all the different episodes the ways they cover up his ears. Yeah. And they just didn't even bother this one. He just said he was a Vulcan traitor. Vulcan traitors are most common, Captain. So
yes. No, and I'm not remembering. So when's the first time we see, for some situation, Spock cover up his ears? Is it City on the Edge of Forever, or is there something before that?
Let's see. There's Assignment Earth. And
which is
Patterns of
two.
Force and Piece of the Action, sort of, because he has the hats. I believe Sidney on the Edge of Forever is the only time, because he doesn't go down to Earth and Tomorrow's Yesterday, so he doesn't cover up his ears. So that hadn't happened. Just a couple episodes away.
We hadn't thought about that for a few episodes. Okay,
right.
I wasn't sure, but
so,
but I'm sure if it had happened before, they would have been like, "Hey, Spock, here's a hat. You're an Organian now."
You know, Kirk and Spock here, you could see Gene Kuhn's hand in this writing. Obviously, he wrote this episode, but the kind of funny interplay between Kirk and Spock, you know, talking about the odds and all this stuff, that's total Gene Kuhn, like, late season two, like, playing up the interplay and comedy between the characters, wasn't it?
Yeah, now, and I love that, you know, where Spock is really specific, like, it's 7,824.7:1. And you had said something about it not being... precise, but, you know, sure sounds precise to Kirk.
Yeah. It's like, well, it's amazing we made it this far. So the running commentary is amazing on that. And even, you know, even when Kirk is like, because, you know, we were talking about Kirk and how kind of has a chip on his shoulder this episode. He's more of an attitude. And Spock is like holding him back from like beating up a Klingon. I was like, well,
it's
I'm
like,
sorry.
Wait a minute.
My friend wasn't look where he was going. We'll be more careful next time. You know, it's like Spock standing up for Kirk. And he was like, did you think I was going to beat his head in? He's like, you might have. He's like, oh, you might have been right. So it's just funny interplay between them. But, This, honestly, and I know it's like, you know, it's a stretch, right? But this kind of like anger towards the Klingons, like, what it reminded me of was Star Trek VI when he just really hates the Klingons, because he just is so indignant in this episode and warning of the Urganians about them. And then I think that his frustrations with that kind of bleeds over to the Urganians almost, because like, when he's talking to them, he's like, I have no great love for you or your way of life, but we're going to go out there and we're going to try to help you people, you know, even if you don't want it. And then he even earlier, like, he tells him, like, I'm used to the idea of dying, but I have no desire to die for the likes of you. It's like, man,
yeah,
that is brutal, Kirk. And Akkor agrees with him. He's like, oh, I know what you mean.
he was being, like,
was
really
in a mood.
Really in a mood. I mean, this is the first time, of course, we on screen see the Klingons, but you figure that Kirk's had some other dealings and he has a great dislike for them. And then, of course, you know, maybe even more so for the Urganians. He's like, what are you doing? These people are going to oppress you. You're going to have no freedom. We can help you. We'll help build up your infrastructure and your defenses. And they're like, oh, we don't need that. And he's like, what are you talking about? Of course you need it. So, yeah, he gets frustrated in, like, all these different directions in this episode. He's like a raw nerve.
Of all those lines, though, my favorite line was probably when they help them escape from jail. And they're coming back to the Urganian council chamber. He says, what are you waiting for the Klingons to post a reward so you can turn us in again and collect it? Like, so good. I love it.
Yeah, it's because I mean, Kirk's really confused. He's like, okay, so you allowed us to come into this jail and now you're breaking us out. How can I possibly trust you? This makes no sense at all. So, I mean, you know, one thing I think about in the episode is, you know, I know the Organians are all about non-interference, but couldn't they at some point, you know, when they see the situation going on, just pull Kirk and Spock aside and be like, look, here's what's going on, and we just want you to understand, and we're all about non-interference, and let's see how we can work this out.
Well, I think they're about to, because when Kirk's first down there doing his plea, he gives them a moment to confer with themselves, then he comes back, and they decide they still don't need his help, and he's still, like, trying to work on him. He's like, Captain, it's clear to us you don't understand us, you know? And then Kirk gets a call from Sulu that the Klingons are attacking, and then that kind of, like, the conversation just veers off in a whole other area. But that's what I thought the same thing. I'm like, could you have just taken 5 minutes, pulled them aside, tell them what was up? And I think that's where they were going to do it, but then everything just escalated from there, and there was no really opportunity to.
That's true, yeah. But I do find, you know, one of the things I find really fascinating about the Organians is, you know, oftentimes in Star Trek, there's, you know, some new alien race, and maybe they start off as hostile, or maybe eventually they're hostile, but here's one that's really just trying their best to not have any hostility and not intervene, and if anything, it probably makes Kirk angrier than if they had just been hostile right away. You know, at least he could understand that.
Yeah, the apathy is the most frustrating thing of all, right?
He's like, what is with you people? Don't you want to, you know, help yourselves or advance yourselves? And yeah, but I do like that, because I think, you know, oftentimes there is a lot of hostility that's coming from different alien races that we see in Star Trek, but I think it's likely that there would be, you know, a good portion out there as well that might be like the Organians, that are like, look, we don't want to make any trouble, you know, just you know, don't worry about us, we're okay, you know.
Right, the pacifists, the true
yeah,
pacifists.
There must be some out there.
Right, but in the original series, and this is something that's played up in the original series, you know, being the Klingons being the Russia of TOS, you know, it's an empire, right? They're conquering, you know, planets or nations, right? And they're like this anti-federation, right?
Right.
That's something that they lose sight of in the TNG era and beyond, because it's like the Klingon Empire is just Klingons, you know. That's it. I mean, every now and then, like in the mind's eye, they have Krios as a Klingon planet, right? But it's not all. Mm-hmm. I assume it's not all Klingons. But that's something that I think that, because, you know, the Russia metaphor went to the wayside, and it came to the samurai Vikings, the Ronald D. Moore. TNG moving forward. So that's something that is an interesting aspect to them, because, you know, they're philosophically, you know, doing the same thing. They're expanding the manifest destiny, they're expanding their territory, all this stuff, and they would naturally come into conflict with each other because they want the same area. That's the, you know, that's what happens. So that's interesting to see that here. You see in Private Little War, you see him talk about it in TOS, you know, Sherman's planet and Trouble with Tribbles, stuff like that, contested territory, all that stuff. And that's something that's an element that's lost to the Klingons, and I think it was you know, hey, again, Discovery, I don't know, maybe we'll see something then. This is the same era, more or less. Pre-OS, as our friend Nick Anastasio coined it. I'm going to use that terminology as much as I can. So.
Yeah, I mean, maybe we'll get, you know, some kind of more background about that. You know, one other way in which this episode, I think, is really important is Aelborn's comment at the end that in the future, the, you know, Klingons and the Federation will work together and become fast friends, which of course, you know, does happen in the TNG era, and you see it in Star Trek VI as well. So I kind of like that they took that little kernel and really built on it later.
Yeah, I mean, completely. I'm sure at the time it's like it's a one-off.
Oh, yeah.
It's a one-off. Klingons are one-off. The Organians are one-off. The future is just completely hypothetical. It's like, oh, yes, in the far... It's like the Q telling Riker, like, oh, one day your guys are going to evolve even more powerful than the Q, right? Yeah. And that's okay. We're never going to see that. But that is, because Star Trek lasted so long and the story went so many places, it is so cool, you're right, to go back and see that. Like, oh, man, they didn't know what they were doing, but they called it in the 60s. That's so cool. So
yeah, I mean, because, of course, at the time, they were like, you know, this show will probably be forgotten about in a couple of years, but hey, this sounds like a cool line to throw in. And of course, they pick it up in the TNG era, and I really love that bit. And whenever I see this episode, I'm like, ah, that's where the little kernel was planted for everything that came later. And I really like in Star Trek how things evolve with the Klingons from this episode all the way through. And, of course, you know, we'll see more probably evolution and different aspects. I mean, from this one episode, from this start, it just kind of became all of these different, you know, Klingon characters and iterations, and we've gotten to know, you know, so much about them, especially in the 24th century. I just like that, you know, this was all the start of that.
Yeah, you know, you even see Kors Baldrick in the original.
That's right. Worf's wearing original. It for the first season of TNG. Yeah.
And as I understand it, was like the same prop.
It was
like they just took it out of storage.
As I understand, it's exactly the same one. And I think if you look at the first season of TNG, which I was rewatching recently, I mean, I think it's pretty clear that, you know, it at least looks very similar, but it's not quite as shiny as in this episode. But I think it's supposed to be exactly the same one. They just pulled it out and they're like, here you go.
That's crazy. And I wonder if there's any attempt has ever been made to explain why Worf has that. Because, you know, starting the second season, he's got the silver one, and it's got, well, they changed little logos on his Baldrick as well, because it eventually becomes the House of Moog, and they changed it to the House of Martok, and that's cool.
Yeah.
It's just one of those things you just kind of like look, it's like O'Brien having Lieutenant Pips, right? You just look over it, you know, it's like, ah, they haven't quite figured it out yet, it's fine. But it's just a cool, like, legacy. Star Trek legacy going all the way to Next Gen. And, you know, even if I'm not sure why they changed it, maybe it was worse for wear, maybe it was the color, but the gold would not have gone with the green the way it went with the red. So I'm glad he changed his Baldrick for season 2. Yeah.
Hey, we could have some headcanon where somehow that original Baldrick from Kor was passed along to the House of Moog because they were they're friendly with Kor's house. I don't know, but
they totally should have done that in the Sword of Kaelas. Worf was like, "Oh man, I had your Baldrick, I had your sash."
Oh, that would have been awesome.
Yeah. Oh man, come on, Ronald D. Moore, step your game up now. But for, you know, for all these Klingons though, I don't know. I gotta say, you know, he's the original. Maybe that's why. And he got more screen time appearing on Deep Space Nine 3 times, as opposed to the other two TOS Klingons did. Kor is my favorite of the TOS Klingons. What about you?
I don't know. I mean, I really like them all, and they're different in different ways. But yeah, because we do get to see Kor in three different DS9 episodes, you get to see more of his personality and who he is. I do like Kor quite a bit, but I like all three of them a lot. And man, that was just amazing seeing all of them in Blood Oath together. You know?
No love for Crass from Friday's Child, huh?
Didn't make as much of an impression, I guess.
And he died at the end, so. And well, I don't even know if the guy from Private War had a name. I think it was just Klingon. I mean, please let us know in the comments, guys. Not quite the encyclopedic knowledge that I sometimes claim to have about about TOS, but I don't think he had a name.
there's so much to know about, but I don't think so either. But yeah, I mean, Kor, Kang, and Koloff, I think, are the ones who made the biggest impression.
Now, I always thought this, and I don't know if I might have seen this idea online somewhere and ran with it, but it would be cool because, you know, there's a lot of Klingons in the TOS movies, right? And so... You think, man, you know, if they would have, okay, like TNG, right? They took the Duras sisters and they became a villain in generations, right? Mm-hmm. So if the original series movies are thinking on a little different track, and I understand why they went with it. Original characters, big name actors, totally understand. I love Christopher Lloyd, Christopher Plummer as the Klingons, absolutely. But if you were going to take these TOS Klingons and transpose them, you know, have them return in the original series movies, I think Kor here would have been an excellent Chang in Star Trek VI, like laughing and quoting things and just enjoying the battle, because he'd finally get the glorious battle that he wanted with Kirk. Now that's one way to do it. And, you know, obviously, if you have to break it all down, then Koloth would be, you know, the washed up ambassador in Star Trek V. I think that would fit him well.
Yeah.
And then Kang would be, you know, Krug from Star Trek III. You know, hand-to-hand combat kind of stuff going on with Kirk. So I think that all fits really well if you wanted to look at it that way. In a what-if scenario, if these guys were just, if they write like a Star Trek Infinities comic and they just want to do that, I think that'd be cool. But Kor fits the best of, you know, if you were going to take him. I think he fits the Chang role very well.
Oh, yeah. And I love some of the things that that Kor says in this episode. I think he's talking to Kirk at one point and he says, "Good, honest hatred. How very refreshing."
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He has so much character. He really relishes all this. And he's so disgusted, this planet of sheep that he complains about, because I'm sure the Klingons, they get an enjoyment, you know, the savagery of them gets an enjoyment over conquering a race, right? Like, oh, look at them cower in fear. And these guys are like, oh, sure, just do whatever you want, you know?
And they probably get enjoyment from the resistance, right? Like, if there are people that are there, they're resisting them or fighting them or doing these things, they're like, ah, chance for battle. And these people that are like, yeah, sure, whatever, you'll have no trouble from us, they're like, ah, how disgusting these people are. They're not even a challenge. And at one point, I think Kor says, like, am I going to kill all of them? Like, how ridiculous is this? I've never had to do that before, you know?
Yeah, I'm sure it was a new experience for them. But you know, switching over to the Enterprise, which you don't see very much in this episode. First of all, Sulu's left in command. This is one of the only times we get to see him in the center seat.
That's right. Because
he'd been left in command in Arena, he was still at his station. I guess there wasn't enough extras that day to fill in for Sulu at the station. And Scotty, not in this episode. So, of course, this is the first season. They hadn't quite established the chain of command yet. Right. So, obviously, he would go on to be like the go-to guy when the big three were off the ship. And this is only one of three episodes that McCoy does not appear in.
That's right. That is it's a really unusual episode in that way. But yeah, seeing Sulu in command is really cool. Makes me wonder if that gave him, you know, a want to be a captain later that we see in Star Trek VI. But yeah, they were still working on establishing things. And yeah, I think it's only a couple episodes that McCoy isn't in. I mean, if he was in this episode, what would his role be, or would it make sense for him to go down to the planet? I mean, if he was in there, where would you want to see him?
Yeah, I don't know. It's nice just to have a Kirk and Spock adventure.
That's
true. Just the two of them. It would have been kind of pushing if they had the three guys, you know, they have to worry about down there. You know, we talk about time now. I mean, there's 50 minutes there for TV, 55, whatever it was back in the 60s. Lots of story to be told there. Not every character can get their moment in the sun. So, I don't know. Like, he might have been able to be there, like, at the very beginning and commented on, oh, what a terrible loss of life and war is awful or something like that, to kind of plant the seeds maybe for what happens later in the episode, even if we don't wrap back around with him, or even if he's on the bridge there when they have their, you know, Kirk and Spock, you know, laughing at the end of the episode kind of thing, as we do in the original series. That's the way I could have seen him kind of bookending everything with just some old country doctor common sense about the horrors of war, perhaps.
Yeah. But I think you're right. They just didn't have time for those kinds of things, because even when you see Sulu, you know, when Kirk orders him to just leave the system because there's a fleet and they're outmatched, they just cut down to the planet. You just don't see him like at all after that until like Kirk and Spock come back. So there isn't much room for anything on the Enterprise.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, you know, they didn't do B stories back then, you know, and 60s TV. Like there's a lot of story here. Like, this is a great, you know, we talked about a few episodes back, What If Old Could Be New Again? The number of which escaped me, so I apologize, guys, but back a few episodes ago, and we were talking about episodes that could turn into movies, you know. And this would be a good one to turn into movies, because you could really expand what was going on down there, maybe have a bigger landing party for Kirk and Spock. Yeah, have a subplot with Sulu being in command of the Enterprise. Hey, just like in Into Darkness, there was a brief snippet of Sulu being in command there of the ship. And I think, yeah, because there's a lot. I mean, you could see, not that it's about the big fleets and about the battles, right? But you could see a little bit of, you know, the Starfleet versus the Klingon fleet. And that's something I would really want to see in one of these movies, you know, just fleet battles, right?
Yeah, I think you're right. They could expand it into a really interesting movie, and you could give more background on the Organians and how they came to be the way that they are, and all of that. But yeah, I mean, as I was rewatching this episode, I have to imagine in my mind, like, oh, there's this Klingon fleet over here, and it looks like this, and this, and a Federation fleet over here that looks like this. But yeah, it would be great just to see that. I mean, even if, of course, there's no hostilities or anything, just seeing those two sides facing each other would just be great to see.
Well, even Kor says, and they're like, oh, think of it, above our heads in space, so the destiny of the next 1,000 years. I'm like, oh, I wish we could see it too. I'm right there with you, man. It's funny. They unintentionally almost bring attention to the fact that we don't see it in the episode.
Yeah, they're like, imagine in your mind, it's somewhere over there, but we're not going to show you what it looks like. But you mentioned something that Kor said. I think he says something like, you know, the battle that happens will affect the galaxy for 10,000 years or something like that. And I'm thinking, like, how could that possibly be? Like, how could it affect things for 10,000 years? So many things can happen in that period of time. But he's feeling like this is going to settle things once and for all. And, you know, the Klingon Empire will be supreme for thousands of years. It's amazing. Right.
And as Kor and Klingons are prone to do, you know, a song was written about this, songs were sung, and, you know, when Worf finally meets him in a sort of kill, he says, oh, your confrontation with Kirk and Arcadia. It's like, well, did he tell you how that went down? Because, like...
Yeah, did he tell you he couldn't do anything and these all-powerful beings made their weapons too hot? Probably
not. I touched him, and then my hand burned up, and I had to stop touching him. Did you notice, though, at the very end of the episode, Kor's, like, going to move towards the Organians, and Kirk reaches to stop him.
He's like, wait a minute.
Yeah, but his hand doesn't burn, right? Because, you know, they're supposed to, like, if you touch each other, they're supposed to burn. So come on, guys. Continuity, guys.
That's a good catch, unless they, you know, took that off when at the last minute when they saw it wouldn't.
I'm sure you could explain if you really
want. Yeah, I'm sure you could explain if you want. But I didn't even think about that, but, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, man. Well, you know, to bring a little culture into our conversation here, this episode title comes from The Life and Adventures of Nicholas Nickleby by Charles Dickens. And the quote is, "It is an errand of mercy which brings me here. Pray, let me discharge it." And that is a classic literary reference from Star Trek titles, and I think it's very apt here. Right, Justin?
Yeah, I mean, because, well, I mean, I think Kirk thinks that they're coming on this errand of mercy to help out these poor Organians who can't defend themselves, right? Is that what you mean?
Right.
Yeah. But, of course, you know, the ones who really in the end can't defend themselves are, you know, Kirk and Kor.
Well, you know, interesting timing with us talking about Errand of Mercy, because the Star Trek official Facebook page actually this past week made a post, "What is your favorite Klingon episode?" And they have a picture from Errand of Mercy with John Colicos there. And so I'll ask you, Justin, is this your favorite Klingon episode?
Ooh, that's a good question. I think it's one of my favorites, but oh boy, I mean, it's one of my favorites, but I mean, I guess it depends on what you define as a Klingon episode, because this one is definitely very much focused on this, you know, on this conflict with the Klingons. I love the Trouble with Tribbles, but I don't know if I'd call that as much a Klingon episode, because it's kind of focused in a bit in a different direction.
Right.
But, you know, there's a lot of episodes that I love from TNG and DS9, like, you know, Sins of the Father and Redemption and sort of Kaelas and Once More Into the Breach and things like, I mean, there's a whole bunch, actually. I feel like there's so many that it would be hard to choose, and I'd have to think about it for a while. But this is definitely up there as one of my favorites, because Kor is such a strong character. It's a really strong introduction of the Klingons. I love the story and kind of looking at this pacifist, non-interfering race and how they interact with the Klingons and the Federation. So it's definitely up there. I don't know if it's number one, but it's pretty high up for me.
Yeah, you'd almost have to break them down by series. Like, I don't think I can't compare Aaron and Mercy to, like, Redemption, you know? Like, you know, I just can't do it, you know? Or Tacking Into the Wind. I mean, that's a brilliant episode. Oh. Like, I go to that one when I think of Deep Space Nine. I go to Worf and Bartok and Gowron, and all coming to a head. So, yeah, it's hard to do. Although, you know, it's in thinking about it here, and we can wrap up with our final thoughts here, but I don't think, at least me personally, there is not a Klingon episode, unless you want to count Tribble of Tribbles, which I don't. Like you said, the Klingons are in it, but they're not really. It's not really a Klingon episode. Other than Trouble Tribbles, I wouldn't put a Klingon episode of TOS in my TOS top 10. You know, I mean, there's just so many other great classics, and for the iconic villain of the show to not be like more represented. Like, I would put like both Romulan episodes in my top 10. You know, I say both. Mm-hmm. I know they're in the Deadly Years. It's stock footage from Balance of Terror with the Bird of Prey. We don't see an actual Romulan, so there you go, guys. I know they're in 3, but just disclaimer. But yeah, Enterprise Incident and Balance of Terror, two of my all time favorites. The Romulans, right?
Me too.
And, it's you know, DC Fontana herself said that the show went more with the Klingons as the big bad, or, you know, the perceived big bad, because the makeup was easier, right? I mean, get some face paint, some beards, you know, and you're good. With the Romulans, even though they did their best with like the helmets to kind of hide the ears, which I thought was very clever, which they reused in A Mock Time for Vulcans, because it all ties together, because ancient Vulcans and Romulans and all that.
Yeah.
Very cool, but, you know, you still got to do the eyebrows, and so anyway, it's just that became, you know, the Klingons kind of filled that role because they're easier to make, you know, armies of them. Like in this episode, like we were talking about at the very start, like, man, they really didn't try very hard with some of that Klingon makeup. So
that's true. I did read that as well, that it was just easier to do the Klingon makeup. Although I think it does beg the question, like, when, you know, and later in Trek, I think when they had, you know, more of a budget for the makeup that they do, I think it's still, you see the Romulans more sparingly than you do the Klingons.
Right. I mean, they got written out of Star Trek 3 because Leonard Nimoy decided to do Klingons instead of Romulans.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we didn't, even in Nemesis, the Romulan movie got Remans instead. It's like, oh,
yeah.
Cheated again. So... But hey, ooh, see this. I keep bringing it back to Discovery. I would say, hey, maybe we'll see some more Rylans in Discovery. Well, we better not, right? If they're going to keep any kind of continuity.
Yeah, I think that we won't really see Romulans in Discovery, because you'd have to do the kind of thing they did in Enterprise. Like, there are Romulans out there, but we don't know what they look like yet. It'd be awkward. So I don't think we'll see that. But yeah, the Klingons, I mean, really, you know, keep becoming a go-to. And for me, that's fine. I love, you know, Klingons and the culture and all of the characters and all of that. I think some people I've seen are kind of sick of it, and they're like, ah, come on, somebody else, Romulans, Andorians, Tellarite, something else. But I love the Klingons, and I really appreciate their presence almost everywhere that you see them, actually.
And it all started here in Aaron and Mercy.
And all started here in this episode from 1967. What, it's a little over 50 years ago now that this episode aired.
Indeed, indeed. All right, Justin, well, it's been fun talking about the first appearance of the Klingons this week, but if people want to keep the Trek conversation going with you online, man, where can they find you?
Well, you can find me on Twitter. My handle is TrekFan4747, where I tweet about nothing but Star Trek. And you can also find me on Facebook, hanging around the Babel Conference.
I'm sure Larry Nemechek loves your Twitter handle there, Justin. So
he did make a comment about it once that he liked the numbers in it. Yeah.
No, I've really enjoyed seeing you, and I've, you know, gone back and forth with you on Twitter a lot as you're watching through TNG, because, you know, I have a special place in my heart for the first two seasons of TNG. You know, the show was good before the callers. I have a very controversial opinion. I feel like seasons 1 and 2 are actually both better than season 7. Of TNG, you know, that's just me. But hey, that's why I host the TOS podcast, not the TNG podcast, I guess, right, Justin?
Well, I mean, I think there is something to be said for what you're saying, because as I'm rewatching, I have a fond place for seasons 1 and 2 as well, because TNG was the kind of the first thing that I really paid attention to and went back to after I saw the first Kelvin Timeline movie. And that's what really got me into it. What was going on in the first couple of seasons? And there's a lot of great episodes. I'm, you know, tweeting about my rewatch for season 2 right now. And season 7 is rocky. It's true. There's some not so good stuff going on in there, like Sub Rosa.
Well, as I said on the From There to Here, our From There to Here rewatch last year, you can retitle Star Trek: The Next Generation season 7 Star Trek: The Family Reunion. I guess it's like every other episode. It's like, oh, my brother and my mom and my dad and, you know, just, ugh. But there was just a certain energy and excitement and a freshness to the first couple seasons that I felt like by the time that season 7 rolled around, it got a little stale. So, hey, the worst season of TNG is the best season of is better than any, like, you know, current TV show, well, you know, within reason. Yep. But most current TV shows, right? So I'm in no way sliding in. And I think all good things forgives all.
So. Oh, yeah, that's amazing. I mean, actually, for me, I do love a lot of what's going on in season 1 and 2, but for me, the peak is season 5 of TNG. There's five? So many episodes I love in there. Oh, yeah, for sure.
I'm a 3 and 4 guy myself, so I'd say 3 and 4 kind of tie at the top for me, and then 5 and 6 are right under that, but now we're just splitting hairs, so.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think they're all good, but for me, you know, 5 has a lot of my favorites. It has Darmok and Ensign Ro and the finishing out Redemption, and I love Time's Arrow, as I said on an Earl Grey episode previously, but and I could probably list out some more if I took a look at it.
What do you think about Silicon Avatar?
It's okay.
I've always loved that episode. I'm like, oh, this is great, you know. And then, you know, you get online, as Brandon Shea Mattel often says, and you get online, you're like, oh, this episode is the worst. I'm like, oh, wait, I love that one.
It's not the worst, but I've always been like, well, this is all right, but no, it's not one of my favorites.
I think it just struck me. I saw it at a young age as a kid, and then like you see the crystalline entity come in and like, you know, wipe out people. I'm like, oh my god, it's scary. So,
oh no, that part is really cool. But just the episode as a whole is just kind of like. It's all right, but that's one of the ones I'm not quite as into. But there's actually, like, when I've rewatched it before, there's a whole bunch in season 5 that I just really love.
All right, well, Star Trek The Next Generation isn't the only thing we're discussing this week on Trek FM. Here's a quick look at what else you might have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Ready Room.
It was a really great police song, for sure.
Droxine!
Yeah, I don't
That's
know.
The one where Leonard Nimoy was singing backup with Sting on that.
Right. Yeah, I can picture Droxine. Yeah. You don't have to put on
it
the Z-Night.
It doesn't have to be every 7 years.
Standard Orbit.
The inscription of this book is a quotation from David Gerrold, which is something he said to me in an email. And he didn't even remember saying it. I met him recently and showed it to him, and he was like, oh, wow, that's a pretty good quote. I didn't know I said that. I'm like, oh, yeah, you did. But he said, the primary philosophy in Star Trek, stripped of everything else, was love one another. I think Jesus might have said something like that once, too.
The Orb.
When something has lasted 50, 60, 70 years by the time you use it, it's already overcome that obstacle of being dated. Like, you know that it's going to remain important through the years, and the fact that someone in the 24th century might still be listening to it, I think makes a lot of sense.
Warp 5.
So we need to hire some samurai to defend us. So they go out looking for some samurai, and they find a group of
about 7 of them.
Yeah, like 7 samurai who are, you know, maybe down on their luck.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, get the show on iTunes or the Apple Podcasts app. Be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly and makes it easier for other listeners to find the show. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, Speaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course, you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. If you'd like to get in touch with us here at Trek FM, you can always find us on trek.fm/contact and look in the sidebar on the show page. Or you can go to speakpipe.com/trekfm and please leave us a voice message. You can also contact us through Twitter at TrekFM, Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM, and The Babel Conference. Type The Babel Conference, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, or go to our website at Trek.FM and click Discussion on the menu bar. Another way you can help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/TrekFM, that's patreon.com/TrekFM, you'll find current goals and different milestone contribution levels along with all the great perks we have for you. These include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, and more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. Speaking of Patreon, thank you as always to our associate producers for Standard Orbit, Renee Roberts, Norman Lau, Aaron Harvey, Tim Robertson, Nick Anastasio, Richard Marquez, and Corey Elron. We could not do this show without you, and you make it all worthwhile every week. As for me personally, you can find me on Twitter at MOOREONZACH. I'm also the host of my own podcast, Always Hold On to Smallville, where we talk about each and every episode of that Young Superman show. You can find us on Twitter at AlwaysMallville with one S. So thanks everyone for listening, and join us again next time here on Trek FM for another episode of Standard Orbit.